Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things. Not because they are easy, but because they are hard.
Okay, Houston, we've had a problem here.
This is Houston. Say again, please.
Houston, we've had a problem.
Welcome to Space Junk. My name is Annie Hanmer, and I study international space cooperation, space treaties, and space debris at the University of Sydney's School of History and Philosophy of Science. Yesterday, I Skyped Daniel Porras, a space security fellow at UNIDIR, the United Nations Institute for Disarmament Research. Daniel focuses on political and legal issues surrounding space security and, in particular, the progressive development of sustainable norms of behaviour for space. He advises governments, academia, and commercial actors on security-related issues such as the development of counter-space technology and the application of international law to space activities. In this episode, we talk about space weaponization, space debris, and India's recent ASAT test. In the spirit of disarmament, Daniel has selected Black Sabbath's War Pigs to begin and end this podcast.
Over Skype with Daniel Porras, who is a space security fellow at the United Nations Institute for Disarmament Research. And I'm currently talking to Daniel in Geneva. Hi.
Hey, how's it going?
Yeah, good. So Daniel's been in Geneva at the meeting of the Group of Governmental Experts, or GGE, as he calls it. Daniel, do you want to tell us a little bit about what you do?
Sure. So I work for the UN Institute for Disarmament Research, or UNIDIR, and we're an independent think tank inside of the United Nations. So a little bit with one foot in and one foot out of the system. But we provide, among other things, technical expertise for various UN processes on the prevention of an arms race in outer space, or other things like space security. But the PAROS, the Prevention of an Arms Race in Outer Space, has kind of been one of the big ones lately that the UN is really trying to further. Unfortunately, this issue's kind of been at a roadblock for quite a lot of years, probably as long as I've been alive, which is probably longer than you would think. But in the last year, we started seeing a lot of movement. And one of the things that the United Nations has been trying to do is they formed a group of governmental experts on further practical measures for the prevention of an arms race in outer space, PAROS. And this group of governmental experts met for two-week sessions over the last year. Well, there was a meeting in August and another in March. And it was 25 experts from all over the world coming together to try and look at elements of what might actually go into a treaty that tries to prevent an arms race in outer space. And fortunately, there seem to be kind of two camps as to how you should really achieve this ultimate goal. On the one side, the Russians and the Chinese, back in 2008, they proposed a treaty that would prevent the placement of weapons in outer space. A lot of countries are very much in favor of this. In particular, countries that are not necessarily considered like, not spacefaring nations, but not really like space actors. However, they're space benefactors, if you will, like, you know, developing countries, you know, countries all across across the world who utilize, you know, they still get the benefits of telecommunications and things. They generally support anything that will prevent an arms race in space. However, a lot of the other spacefaring nations think that maybe the conditions aren't necessarily right for a treaty, particularly one on the placement of weapons in space. So this is a lot of the Western countries, such as, you know, the United States, Canada, Australia, Japan, which are not Western countries, but in the UN, we consider them a part of sort of the Western group, as well as, you know, the UK, France, Italy, Germany, the Netherlands. And one of their issues with the prevention of the placement of weapons in space is that, one, what's a weapon in space? How do you define a weapon in space? So much of our technology is, you know, what we call dual use, in the sense that it can be used for civilian or military purposes, but it's also multi-purpose. Like, something can be defensive or it can be offensive, but it's really hard to tell what things are in space. So we can't even really define weapon. So how do you verify that people are not just complying, but like nobody's stepping out of the lines or that anyone's cheating? And it's pretty tough to do. And then the other issue is that it also doesn't cover everything. When we talk about the prevention of the placement of weapons in space, there's not an explicit reference in that title to preventing ground-based weapons from being used against objects in space. So the recent India demonstration, the Indian test that just took place where they blew up a satellite, something like that might not necessarily be covered. Although within the actual text, something could be added potentially in a treaty to cover that kind of thing. And then you just change the title, I suppose. But this group of governmental experts met in Geneva for the last 2 weeks to try and talk about different possibilities of how you might be able to work something like that out, along with other different approaches, maybe completely different ideas about how you could do how you could potentially have a treaty. And I mean, unfortunately, we weren't able to get to a consensus on any particular approach. But we discussed a lot of really great ideas. And I think in the future, we'll be able to utilize some of those to kind of take these ideas forward and, who knows, come up with some other ideas. And another approach, of course, that has been discussed by the Western countries, they don't just come up with I don't want to say criticisms necessarily, but objections to the treaty. But they do have their own proposals as well. And one is to propose voluntary measures. So what we call transparency and confidence building measures of a non-legally binding nature. And those, you could come up with a variety of things, but it would mean that states would voluntarily offer up information rather than having someone sort of checking in on them. And at the same time, there wouldn't be sort of like a legal aspect to it. It's sort of like a promise. So a country says, okay, I promise to, for example, not create more debris than is absolutely necessary. And most countries tend to follow that. So there are these space debris mitigation guidelines in the United Nations, and most countries tend to be pretty good about not creating more debris than is necessary. But every once in a while, you know, things go in a different direction. And so we have to have maybe some rules of the road to determine how we conduct activities in outer space to make sure that we can keep doing it for a long time. And so this group of governmental experts, I think, was a good step in the direction, in the conversation. But it's pretty clear that we've still got a long way to go.
So let's talk for a minute about the Chinese anti-satellite test in 2007. So my understanding is that there were discussions happening about regulating space weapons, but that the 2007 test really focused the world's attention on the need to do it and also to regulate the creation of debris in space. Mm-hmm. Is that a fair assessment, or is there more history there that we're missing?
No, I mean, there was a little period there around 2007 to 2009 that really highlighted the dangers of space debris. But up until the 2007 incident, there hadn't really been a lot of sort of single events that just really kicked up the amount of debris that was being created in space. So if you look at there are lots of graphs and charts out there that show you the amount of debris that has been created over the last 50 years, and you see these big jumps. right in 2007 when the Chinese ASAT test took place. And that was done at an altitude where the debris was up so high that it's going to be there for, I mean, I've heard estimates anywhere between decades and hundreds of years. So
that
continues to pose a threat to other objects.
And maybe that's part of the point as well. Like, we don't necessarily know exactly how long that debris will be up there because we're still not entirely sure of the, you know, various forces at play. China did their test at 800 kilometers, I think. Is that right? So still in low Earth orbit, but reasonably high up.
The International Space Station, you know, flies as low as 400, you know, it's between like 400 kilometers and I can't remember how high it goes exactly, but they definitely have to take that into consideration. There are a lot of other low Earth orbit satellites that operate at that height. So it's presented a problem over the last few years, and we hope that it doesn't, you know, continue to create more, you know, to generate more debris. It's one of those self-perpetuating problems.
Yeah. So what happened in 2007? Can you talk us through the Chinese ASAT test?
Sure. It was China had a defunct weather satellite that was flying around, and they were able to use a direct ascent kinetic kill missile, which is essentially a missile that has like a big, big sort of warhead, like a ramming device in the front, and they just launch it really, really fast and are able to strike a satellite, and they were actually able to destroy it. It created quite a bit of debris. I think it was somewhere around like 2,000 pieces of debris, a little over 2,000 pieces of debris. And that stuff's going to be there for a pretty long time. And because it was done technically during a peacetime situation, there was no necessity necessarily to do this test. Any of that trash were to hit something else, and we were able to attribute that trash to the Chinese test, and China would technically be liable under the liability convention.
Right.
So the UN liability convention on, you know, objects in space.
Yeah. So the liability convention is one of the major treaties governing space activities that came out after the Outer Space Treaty. And basically it says that if you put something in space, you're liable for it and you're liable for the parts thereof. So if you have a defunct satellite or bits that have broken off your satellite and they run into something else, you're liable for that. You're supposed to make sure that doesn't happen.
Yeah. You know, it's a fairly sensible approach to space activities, you know, very, very much in line with rules of the road that we have here on Earth. The liability convention doesn't necessarily dissuade people from doing these kinds of tests. So in space security terms, one of the reasons why the Chinese ASAT test was also really marks a shift in the way that things were, the trends that were happening at the time, is because the following year, the United States, who hadn't done an active sort of ASAT test in quite a long time, they did a demonstration. There was a NASA satellite that had been launched that wasn't working. It was still full of hydrazine, and it provided a very good opportunity for the United States to use one of its ballistic missile interceptors to intercept the satellite on the way down and destroy it to make sure that the satellite would burn up. Mm-hmm. But it was very convenient that it happened the very following year after China had just done a test. And all of a sudden, everyone was talking about the necessity to develop ASATs. And this conversation really started picking up pace after these two events. And in particular, we started hearing conversations in India from folks who were saying, you know, China is a geopolitical rival for us, and we're concerned that they might pose a threat to some of our space assets. And in order to dissuade them or deter them or anyone for that matter, from trying to, interfere with China's space systems, that they needed to carry out an ASAT test as well, which is what just happened.
Cool. Yeah, I was going to say that takes us to last week, which was Wednesday evening, Australia, Sydney time.
Yep.
And tell us what happened.
So, The Indian, was it the Defense Organization for Research and Development? And ISRO, which is the Indian Space Agency, they together carried out a test of a missile interceptor that was able to destroy a satellite, which was flying at about 300 kilometers. The satellite, it was an Indian television satellite. It was only launched in January, and I'm not entirely sure if it's specifically intended for this test or not, but it was very much seen as being a statement or declaration of arrival for the Indian space program by the Indian Prime Minister, who delivered a quite big national statement right afterwards. And I think they created something around 270 pieces of debris at 300 kilometers. Not terribly high. The debris won't stay up for decades. It will probably just stay up for weeks, maybe months. Probably within 2 years, none of the debris will be left in orbit. But there are other things that are flying in that orbit. In particular, I think the company Planet Labs, the ones who do the all the cool photos from space. I think their constellation flies at around 300 kilometers. So some of that trash could be a problem for them. Hopefully it won't be. Again, because India did this as a test, the liability convention does apply.
Right. And generally speaking, I think around that orbit, you'd have a fair number of sort of geosurveillance satellites of various sorts declared or otherwise.
And like I said, the International Space Station flies around 400 kilometers. So it is well within the range of some of the possible projectiles to get up to that height. But one of the really interesting aspects of this, though, is that given all the technology that has developed over the last few years on targeting and potentially disrupting space systems, these missiles, like ballistic missile interceptors, is probably the most expensive and maybe least efficient means of taking out a satellite or taking out that space system. Can electronically interfere with a satellite. You can potentially hack a space system. Now that we're developing on-orbit surface vehicles, that's kind of seeming to be another option. I know some folks are looking at lasers and other things. So a direct ascent missile kind of seems a little bit not terribly utilitarian, especially if you're considering going up against a country, a major space superpower like the US or Russia or China. Being able to shoot down one satellite is probably not going to be terribly effective. You would probably have to take out numerous satellites because they have redundant systems. So, doing something like this, it seems more like India was trying to do this for prestige purposes. Sort of to say like, we know that there are some of the there's a special club of space superpowers that can destroy satellites. Well, we're a part of that club as well. And, I suppose I can understand some of the reasons for it, especially because there are elections coming up in the next 2 weeks in India. So Prime Minister Modi, I know, has gotten in trouble for making his national speech about this test. We'll see how that goes. But I tend to feel that this was probably done less for, testing purposes. I think India probably already knew they could do this, but it was more sort of to declare that their missile defense system is really sophisticated, that they can hit something even in space, and sort of to act as a deterrence against others from potentially interfering with their space systems. But again, I'm not entirely sure whether this technology really proves that point.
Right. So why don't we have a quick chat about space weaponry in general. Mm-hmm. And this is something that I think you are a bit of an expert in. But before, when you were giving an introduction, you mentioned the problem of dual use technologies and basically the difficulty in defining what is a space weapon or even defining what is a weapon in general. And it seems to me, I just skimmed through some sort of transcripts of various activities on this subject at UN conventions. And it seems to me that the problem of definitions and defining what is a weapon is one that kind of is tricky because people are trying to define it in terms of a technology. So they're trying to say this technology is or isn't a weapon for the purposes of making an agreement. But in actual fact, the blurring of civil and military uses of space is such that really what you're trying to regulate or define is the intent behind that use of that technology. And that's a really hard thing to do with an agreement.
Yeah, and that's come to be one of the big problems that we have, because in coming up with an agreement, you don't want to restrict beneficial technology. So, you know, for example, on-orbit service vehicles seems to be one of the big issues that comes up with dual use, because in theory, an on-orbit service vehicle can be used to repair a satellite. It can be used to refuel a satellite, so life extension operations. It can be used to move a dead satellite into a graveyard orbit so that it no longer poses a threat as debris to other objects in, you know, some of the useful orbits. It could potentially be used to remove debris. I know we just saw the big experiment from the University of Surrey with their cool space harpoon. but at the same time, when you look at the space harpoon, if you are in a situation where the world is very tense, where countries are getting very competitive again, and everyone is more reliant on space activities, especially for the military, you see a space harpoon and you think, that's not debris removal, that's a weapon. That's something that you're planning to use to destroy one of my satellites or to remove one of my satellites and to inhibit my ability to use space for my military operations. And, you know, how do you draw the line? In many ways, it's hard to know. I mean, even this glass of water, for example, if I'm just drinking the glass of water, it's just a glass of water. But as soon as I hit somebody over the head with the glass, it becomes a weapon. So how do you determine what some of these objects are really intended to do? We have had a number of examples here in the past where one country will, you know, accuse is quite a strong word, but it might also be the right word, have accused others of having satellites in space that, you know, one country claims is they're doing scientific research and the other one says, no, you're up there developing a weapon. You know, two examples that we can think of, or at least one example we can think of, is last year, the United States made accusations against the Russians that the Russians had a satellite in space with, you know, these two little like bits, these other kind of probes that came off of it, it circled the satellite and moved around and then reconnected. And the Americans said, oh, you're developing a weapon. The Russians said, no, we're just developing an on-orbit service vehicle, much like you are as well. And, you know, it's just a scientific experiment. And the Americans said, no, it's a weapon. But you can't prove it. I mean, how do you prove that it was a weapon or not? Likewise, the Russians have come out and said that the Americans are developing certain types of technology that could also be weapons. And they can't prove it any further than just saying, well, we saw this little satellite moving around in these bizarre orbits and making weird maneuvers. So we think you're developing something to be able to like grab our satellites and pull them out of orbit. Okay, well, unfortunately, we can't really tell what things can do until they do them, especially because they're in space and it's very hard to know. And even once you see an object do something, you're not totally sure why it's doing it. Another example of a situation where there was an accusation and not a lot of evidence to back it up was last year as well. The French Ministry of Defense came out and said that a Russian satellite was intercepting communications from one of their military satellites, and that, you know, that the Russians had sent this little probe to kind of park itself really close to the satellite, and that it was the only reason it could be there would be to intercept communications. And you know, the truth of the matter is it's possible. That little probe had actually gotten really close to another Pakistani satellite. So it's hard to know, you know, who it was, if it was spying on in the first place, and if so, against who. But you know, other countries have done activities like this and people didn't necessarily panic. But you can't offer up any specific evidence at why objects are doing things if you're just looking at them.
Mm. And there's that real gray area between military and civil military uses of space and military uses of space all the way along the supply chain. So, I mean, a researcher who's got expertise in civil rocketry technology equally could be applied, like their research could equally be applied to military uses. And even the technologies that you're using, the component parts, could also have the same thing going on where I know in Australia we've got some really cool activities where they're basically firing a very powerful laser at pieces of space debris in order to just move them slightly in their orbit and yep. make them deorbit faster. But the technology that they're using to achieve this has been borrowed from weapons companies because they're the ones who have this technology readily available and, are willing to kind of get involved. And so on one hand, it's actually a purely civil space debris removing activity, which is being done by Australia. So everyone's pretty sure that it's above board. But at the same time, if this activity was being done by a different country, then it might not be so kind of PC.
Yeah. And, if you read some of the reactions to the technology developments that are being carried out or that are being achieved by Western countries, for example, in the US and across Europe, we heard about the space harpoon. It was like, oh, great, we're going to be able to remove debris. Well, in China, it was more like, this company is developing weapons, could potentially be developing a weapon for the military to try and, spear Chinese satellites.
Right.
In conflict. So, it's hard to be able to determine. And so one of the reasons that we're trying to come up with treaties or with transparency and confidence building measures, at least, is to try and lower the fear factor with some of those technological developments to make sure that people don't see these experiments or see these developments and think, things are getting hotter. There's a bigger possibility for conflict in space. Therefore, we need to continue developing new technologies. Another great example of this is the U.S. Recently, the U.S. Put out their missile defense review and called for greater emphasis on space-based missile detection. So this would mean putting up, sensors in space that would be able to monitor the Earth for launches of intercontinental ballistic missiles or other types of missiles. Okay, that sounds sensible enough. But then along with that, they also call for, and again, the utility of this is highly questionable, but they also call for looking at placing missile interceptors in space. So being able to shoot down, when a missile just gets launched, to be able to launch the interceptor from a satellite to destroy it. Again, because the utility of it is so highly questionable, a lot of countries look at that and say, that's not for defense. You're planning on having missiles in orbit to be able to reach ground targets. So it's, like I said, the dual use problem, I think, is actually four dimensional in the sense that it's civilian and military, but also offensive and defensive purposes.
Yeah, it's a classic question of kind of unknowability, the kind of thing. Yeah. If anyone's interested in this, go and Google in sociology of science or science and technology studies, the problem of GRU and BLEEN. It's like you don't know until you've actually looked at that thing specifically. And even then it's unknowable because it could be either. It really interests me. And so I agree with you in a sense that I feel that those cooperative activities, those confidence building measures and sharing of information and so on are a really good way to make people relax a little bit about what's going on and not necessarily assume that we're in the middle of an arms race in space. But at the same time, you can see why governments, especially the US government, would be nervous about teaming up with other nations to do cooperative scientific research on something that could potentially have military applications, because in their mind they'd say, well, if there is an arms race, we're just helping the other side catch up to where we are. So how do you balance those two things?
Yeah, I think we have some much larger problems than just necessarily an arms race in outer space, and that is just one of the issues, or sort of one of the dimensions of a much larger problem. And so, space is just one vehicle, one mechanism that we can use to try and get to know each other better, I think, and to try and figure out, you know, what are our objectives, and you know, how can we achieve all the things that we want for our countries, for our world, for people everywhere, I guess, in ways that, you know, aren't necessarily mutually exclusive, I hope. When we often talk about, Russia's ambitions in space, China's ambitions in space, U.S. ambitions in space, we talk about it in this dynamic of a race. I often wonder, what are we racing towards? And when we look at a lot of the stated goals and objectives, it doesn't seem like there isn't enough space for everyone. So the questions that we're having is more about mistrust and doubts. And I think there are very simple things that we can do to start in order to try and make better conditions for cooperation and ultimately, you know, putting the guns down. And of course, I work for the United Nations. Our entire purpose is to try and free the world of the scourge of war. So it's not, it's no secret that I'm here working on disarmament.
Right.
I think there is a hope that by engaging in some of these activities, or especially in the simple things, like just starting to build on easy things, for example, notifications about rocket launches. Like, that's something that is, people can offer up information and we can verify the accuracy of that information. So, you know, and I'll explain. The transparency and confidence building measure, I think, to me, is an area where countries offer up information willingly. So the flow of information is from me to you. But verification is your ability to confirm that what I just told you. So that's going from you to me. And I think if countries willingly offer up certain types of information, and then we can regularly identify that it's true, we start to build trust, and you can actually take people at their word. And unfortunately, even in outer space, where we have these incredibly sophisticated systems, they're very, very expensive. A lot of times, our understanding of what's going on up there is based on trust of somebody else's word, that somebody says, look, my X-37B is not carrying a nuclear weapon. And as much as some people want to look at this Boeing test vehicle that is up in space, that a lot of people don't know what it necessarily does, you know, we can't confirm that it doesn't necessarily have something on board that could be considered a weapon. We just take it on trust. So we have to build on that. And at the moment, especially between the big powers, there's not a lot of trust. So I think if we start small, work on some really basic things, we can start building a little bit more trust and ultimately create a condition or a situation where, you know, people say, all right, we're going to talk about a treaty of not placing weapons in outer space. And even though a verification program isn't perfect, relationships are such right now that we are willing to take some things on faith, minimal ones, hopefully, because let's face it, when it comes to the military, you want to reduce faith to as little as possible, but at least to be willing to engage in a discussion or go through a process where you think, look, we can get it up to 99%, but I'm willing to take that 1% on faith. Okay, let's do it. And we're just not there yet. Hopefully we will be someday.
I definitely hope so. And so one area where we can definitely do that is in debris removal. I think that makes sense as a kind of debris prevention, debris removal makes sense as an area that we can cooperate and start to build that trust, because ultimately it's in everybody's interests to not have space full of debris. Debris does not discriminate. It can hit anyone, even the person who launched it in the first place, as happened to France with their Ariane rocket.
The big one that I always think of, though, is just the we were talking earlier about the big events that created a lot of debris, and we had that collision of the Iridium satellite and the Cosmos satellite in 2009.
Yeah.
And that created tons of debris.
So when I met you last year, it was at the International Astronautical Congress in Bremen, and you were presenting a paper on debris mitigation, was it? And it was basically titled No Debris, Low Debris Notification.
Yeah,
I was hoping you could tell me a little bit about that.
Sure. So last year, I wrote a report that we published through UNIDIR about developing anti-satellite test guidelines. So one of the reasons that I wanted to address this issue is that I think it's relatively low-hanging fruit in the sense that we all have an interest in not generating debris. Like you said, when debris is created, then it could potentially affect anyone. And so in order to continue benefiting from all of our space systems, we should try and figure out what are some of the things that we can all agree on, like that we can have wide consensus. And a pretty straightforward one seems to be that not that many people seem to want kinetic direct ascent ASAT missiles, so anti-satellite missiles. But for the people who do want them and who do want to, or at least have the capabilities of destroying an object in space intentionally, at least do it in such a way that will not create a bigger debris problem. So I put three principles into five words. And these are based on recommendations that were made by another group of governmental experts when they published their report in 2013. The idea is no debris. So if you're going to test a kinetic anti-satellite system, don't create debris. Low debris. If you have to create debris, like the Indians just did because they, you know, obviously wanted to hit something to prove that they could do it at an altitude low enough so that it doesn't leave long-lasting debris. And then notification. Tell somebody. Sometimes if you do a test like this, you can make a lot of other people very nervous. They could potentially think that it is a different type of launch or that you're trying to hit something else. So in order to not heighten tensions and make other people, very, very nervous, you should probably at least call someone and say, this is what we're doing, and here are some of the measures that we've taken to make sure that we're not going to create debris. It seems like low-hanging fruit. I'm sure if we put some efforts behind this, we could do it. And there seems to already be a general consensus that, well, not a consensus, but at least a norm building that if someone is going to do something like this and they're going to destroy a satellite in space, they should do it, it seems like somewhere between 200 and 300 kilometers is about the acceptable range, at least. The Indians are, of course, going to get some criticism, but in general, they're not getting criticized nearly as much as the Chinese did in 2007.
Well, I think I should probably let you go soon to catch your flight, because you've got to fly. You said you were heading to London to talk about space situational awareness.
I'm actually going to listen to a conference on military space situational awareness. So, like I said, this issue of verification is really important. So I'm delighted to have an opportunity to go and hang out with some technicians and to be able to learn about it.
Sounds fantastic. Do you have anything that you wanted to finish up with? Any last thoughts?
A note of hope, I suppose. The last 2 weeks were definitely draining, and it was a pity that we weren't able to reach consensus within the group of governmental experts. But I do think that we generated some really great ideas, and I hope that we're able to build on them.
I think we can all hope for that. Thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it. I know it's very early in Geneva, so thank you so much for waking up and podcasting. If people want to know more, they can follow you on Twitter. Is that right? So your handle would be?
It's @SpaceDAPorus, P-O-R-R-A-S. But you can also check out our website, unidir.ch. I think, for Switzerland. Or you can just look up, yeah, Google UNIDIR, UNIDIR. And yeah, we have plenty of more information there, and you can also find some of our reports.
Fantastic. Thank you so much.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Amy.
Thank you for listening to Space Junk. If you would like to find out more about anything in the podcast, you can tweet me on @ahandmer. That's Afe Annie, H-A-N-D-M-E-R. For fellow Black Sabbath fans, I'll now leave you with the rest of the song. For the rest of you, until next time.
Gathered in their masses, just like witches at black masses. Evil minds that plot destruction, sorcerer of death's construction. In the fields of bodies burning, machine keeps turning. Death and hatred to mankind, poisoning their brainwashed minds. Oh, Lord, yeah. Darkness world stops turning, ashes where the body's burning.
No more war pigs have the power. And as God has struck the hour, day of judgment, God is calling. On the knees, the war pigs crawling, begging mercies for the sins. Satan laughing spreads his wings. Oh, Lord, yeah.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Welcome back to Two Judgy Girls. I'm Mary from the Bay.
And I'm Courtney from LA. TJG is the podcast where we spill all the tea on your favorite reality TV shows, celebrity gossip, and everything in between. We're here to bring you our unfiltered opinions, hilarious commentary, and plenty of laughs along the way.
We're two SDSU Delta Gamma sisters with a microphone and a whole lot of opinions. Each week, we dive headfirst into the wild world of reality television, from Bravo to all the trash TV you could want. We break down the drama, dissect the latest scandals, and share our thoughts on everything from the jaw-dropping moments to the embarrassing antics.
But that's not all. We're not here to just gossip. We're here to connect with you, the jurors, and share our love of all things pop culture. Whether we're dishing on the latest celebrity breakups, discussing our favorite guilty pleasure movies, or sharing embarrassing stories from our own lives, we promise to keep it real, keep it fun, and keep you coming back for more.
Come judge with us.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.